You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, let me convene this all-too-ruly crowd. I'll begin by introducing myself. I'm Bill Galston, a senior fellow in governance studies here at Brookings. And on behalf of the Governance Studies Division and Brookings, I'd like to welcome you all to the latest session of our long-running hit series entitled Governing Ideas. I see a number of veterans in the audience, but for the first comers, let me just take 30 seconds or so to explain the idea behind Governing Ideas. I don't need to tell you that in this town there is a whole lot of discussion about politics, with an occasional deviations, thanks to Ezra Klein, who's here with us today, into the finer points of public policy. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about the broader context and environment within which both our political fights and our policy debates unfold, an environment that includes political institutions, our history, our political culture, moral values, and a number of other things besides. And the point of Governing Ideas as a series is to try to get back, to back up a few steps and to look at some of the broader issues that we confront and some sweeping visions as to how to think about them and how to confront them. My usual practice in these events is to offer a very brief introduction and then sit down and get out of the way. I'm going to deviate from that practice this afternoon, alas, for a regrettable and sad reason. I'm dedicating this session to the late Peter David. I suspect that many of you knew him and more of you heard of him. He was a revered journalist, a much-loved human being at the time of his death. The Washington Bureau Chief of The Economist, that death was incurred senselessly at the hands of an apparently reckless driver last Thursday night. By chance, Peter and I had lunch the day before his death. It was a much deferred lunch, but thank God, not deferred once too many times. And the main topic of that lunch, not entirely by chance, was the same as the topic of today's sentence. We talked about Ed Luce's book, Time to Start Thinking, America in an Age of Dissent, which we'll be discussing this afternoon. And we also talked more broadly about the topic of Ed's book, namely, is America in decline or not? How would we know? Also not by chance, this topic was the subject of Peter's very last Lexington column, the column that he wrote for The Economist that appeared the day before he died. And after reviewing the evidence on both sides of this issue and reminding his readers about the last bout of what he, among others, termed declinism, the bout in the 1980s sparked by the challenge from Japan and Germany, he concluded with a brief peroration entitled The Binary Illusion. And in Peter's memory, let me read the last two paragraphs. This prose and this way of thinking were entirely characteristic of Peter and help explain why he was so respected and loved in his profession more broadly. People tend to think in black and white. America is either in decline or is ordained to be forever the world's greatest nation. Government is either paralyzed or it is running amok, stifling liberty and enterprise and snuffing out the American dream. The election campaign accentuates the negative and sharpens this binary illusion. The Republicans say that Mr. Obama is leading America into socialized serfdom. The Democrats retort that Mr. Romney would restore the conditions that caused the recession. Little wonder that, according to polls, most voters do not believe that either man has a clear plan for fixing the economy. Charles Dickens said of the United States, that if its citizens were to be believed, America, quote, always is depressed and always is stagnated and always is at an alarming crisis and never was otherwise. On a variety of objective measures, Peter continues in his own voice, it is an awful mess right now. And yet America, of all countries, still has plenty of grounds to hope for a better future, despite its underperforming politics and no matter who triumphs in November. Well, those are the views of one Briton who worked hard to understand the United States and who manifestly, patently wished our country well. We're here this afternoon to discuss a book with somewhat contrary views, also penned by a Briton who is a superb reporter, who has dedicated himself tirelessly to understanding the United States, its circumstances, and its prospects, and who yields nothing to Peter David in wishing American citizens and our country well. Before moving on to the main event, let me just offer a very brief introduction of the speaker, the author, and the two commentators. There are fuller bios available in your materials. Ed Luce is the Washington columnist and commentator for the Financial Times. Among his other former gigs was serving as speechwriter for then-Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, although I suspect few of you could guess that from the contents of Ed's book. And he was previously author of one of the most highly regarded books on the rise of modern India. And speaking of highly regarded books, this book, which received a favorable front page review in the New York Times book section, is available for sale out in front. And if you are patient and wait until the end of this session, I suspect the author would even be willing to smile at you and sign it for you. Yeah. We are very grateful to have two superb commentators. First, Ezra Klein, who is, among his many other accomplishments, columnist at the Washington Post, a contributor to MSNBC. As most of you know, he focuses on domestic and economic policy making, as well as the vagaries of our political system that get in the way of domestic and economic policy making. And he reports that he, quote, really likes graphs, for those of you who hadn't guessed. To his right is Glenn Hutchins, a man with a lengthy list of accomplishments. Let me just offer three, not in descending order. He is the vice chairman of the Brookings Board of Trustees. He's the co-founder of Silver Lake, one of the world's largest firms investing in technology and technology-related businesses. And he's also a director of the Federal Reserve Board of New York, along, I take it, with Jamie Dimon. Is that correct? We'll see how long that lasts. Now, just a word of introduction about our topic. I already mentioned the term declinism. It has become, in some circles, a dismissive epithet. But even a cursory inspection of history suggests that at some point, declinism is the right optic to bring to the trajectory of every nation, no matter how great or powerful. Every great empire known to us has declined. Many have disappeared. Likewise for every great nation. Occasionally, empires and nations are great, decline, and then claw their way back. Footnote to the contemporary People's Republic of China. We cannot, in principle, on the face of it, dismiss the possibility that the United States stands at such an inflection point. We do not know that it does. And as we'll see this afternoon, there will probably be a frank and free disagreement as to what counts as evidence that we do stand at such a point. And as Peter mentioned at the end of his column, our capacity for national adjustment, for recognition of error, for change of course, for self-renewal, helps explain why the United States is still here. And I was about to say standing tall, maybe, you know, stooped and crouched would be a little bit more like it. But at any rate, we're still on our feet. And the question before us is whether that capacity for adjustment, change of course, and self-renewal remains vigorous enough, despite the vagaries of our political system, to pull it off one more time. Finally, our agenda. Ed Luce is going to kick off presenting the principal ideas of his book in about 15 minutes. Ezra Klein and Glenn Hutchins will offer 10 minutes of remarks in that order. I then plan to do some moderated crosstalk up here, and then in the final portion of our session, to turn to you for questions and comments. So, without further ado, Ed.
Thank you very much, Bill. Before I start, I'd just like to echo and underline Bill's comments about Peter David, who was also a friend, a recent friend of mine, not a long-standing one, but somebody who, in a very short period of time, the 3-4 years that I knew him, made an enormous mark on me as one of the most generous, wise, and kind journalists. He was in his last tour of duty for The Economist and clearly relishing covering this country, a country he deeply loved. And I think the fact that his final column was an optimistic column about the United States, beautifully argued. He actually cited me in the column in disagreement with my book, and I couldn't think of a more honored way to be disagreed with than in Peter David, in a Peter David column. So I just wanted to underline that. I also wanted to thank Bill, first of all, not only for convening this, but also over the years since I've been based here, as one of the most sage and insightful people to whom any journalist can turn. And Bill will know from the odd times at which your cell phone is rung that I'm one of the worst culprits on that score. And then finally, to thank both Ezra and Glenn for showing up. I couldn't relish more your critiques. I don't know what you're going to say, but I'm looking forward to it. On to what I am going to say. I'm not very good at doing this in 15 minutes, so I'm going to try and compress it. My mother asked me the other day how my book was going, and 45 minutes later said, I really regret asking you that. So I'm going to give you the third length. Two brief caveats before I get on to, I think, sort of the three core highlights of the book I'm going to provide you. The caveats are this. First, it's not quite as suicidally depressing as it might sound or as the beautiful artwork on the front of the book might suggest. The artwork on the British edition, which I managed to kibosh at the last moment because it really didn't represent the book at all, had the Statue of Liberty with a gun at her head. So any of you who think that those values are confined to tabloid newspapers in Britain is sadly mistaken. The New York Times, in the review that Bill mentioned, the Jonathan Rauch review, in a very funny line said this book should be renamed Time to Start Drinking. I don't think it's quite that bad. Nevertheless, in some of the responses I've got to this book in the last 3-4 weeks since it came out, but also in some of the conversations I've had with others before it came out, because I'm not the first to make this line of argument, obviously, I've heard a fairly common response, which is America always rises to challenges. It's whether you're talking about the Great Depression, Pearl Harbor, Sputnik, even the rise of Japan in the late 80s, well, in the early to late 80s, and its challenge to America's high-tech might in the semiconductor industry. In all of these instances, America responded, overcame its challenges, and moved on. And that's correct. But I would submit that the challenges I'm about to set out, namely America's response or non-response, more to the point, to the deeply complex challenges posed by globalization and exponentially changing technology and what that does to the way most Americans live and work is a very different kind of challenge to the ones I mentioned earlier. When Nazi war Germany declares war on you, you unite. When Sputnik is launched and the specter of Soviet nuclear predominance looms, you unite. The responses to these, and even to Japan in the late 80s, when the Reagan administration, of all administrations, was the last one really to sustain an industrial policy on manufacturing, all of these commanded bipartisan responses, relatively speaking. Even the Great Depression, when Roosevelt had such commanding majorities in his first term, you could say commanded the majority of the American people. Now, these challenges, globalization, technology, are inherently divisive. So I think those people who say, and I quote Tocqueville in the book, that America's greatest strength is her ability to repair her faults. I agree with that. But those people who leave it at that are, I think, reinforcing precisely the kind of complacency from which America has been suffering, and particularly in the last decade or so. So it's not quite time to start drinking, but I do recommend one Prozac per chapter, because there isn't, I don't parachute a Hollywood ending into this book. The second brief caveat, and do keep time on me, Bill, is that I'm obviously not delivering this message in the ideal accent. I do have the wrong accent to make the points that I'm making. So I would like to underline that I've been fairly embarrassed in the last few years by compatriots of mine, whether they're prime ministers urging America into very dubious wars of choice, whether they're Harvard scholars urging America to be the explicit last carrier of the English-speaking baton. I'm sometimes embarrassed to share an accent with the most adulatory of my compatriots when it comes to America. Equally, there is the type of Brit who sneers at America, who I'm also very embarrassed to share a passport with. I think rather unfairly, Sam Huntington, the late Sam Huntington, in response to Paul Kennedy, a compatriot of mine, who wrote that famous declinist book in the late 80s, defined American declinism, and Bill will correct me if I'm wrong, defined American declinism as somebody who actively wishes for America's decline, not somebody who's diagnosing it, but who's actively wishing for it. And I'm very much not in that camp either. I don't, to be fair to Paul Kennedy, think he is. If I'd been alive in 1956, and this is the end of the second caveat, I'd like to think that I would have supported automatically and very strongly Dwight Eisenhower's decision to pull the plug on what remained of British power over the Suez crisis. Equally, as long as Mel Gibson isn't starring in it or producing it or directing it, then if I ever see a movie about the Redcoats fighting the Colonials, my heart is usually with the Colonials. So end of caveat. I'm not either an over-adulatory or over-sneering Brit. Just want to make that clear. I'm going to start slightly unfairly by picking on a very august name associated with this institution, Bob Kagan, whom I rate very highly, whose book, Dangerous Nation, amongst others, but in particular, is one of the best works of scholarship I've read in recent years about America and the world. But I'm going to pick on him because the president picked on him, picked on the essay that he wrote earlier this year, which was an excerpt from the book, The Myth of America's Decline, that Bob wrote. And the premise of the book is that America's share of global GDP has, at 25%, remained at a quarter of world income, remained remarkably steady, in his words, since the late 1960s. And President Obama picked up on this, and he said, I think you'll all remember in the State of the Union, that anybody who talks of American decline doesn't know what they're talking about. The reason I pick on this is because the premise is wrong. I discovered the source of his data, which is a rebased USDA calculation in 2005 dollars, and went to the IMF to check the correct numbers. And it, depending on which measure you choose, purchasing power parity, market rates, or rebased dollar rates, you get a steady decline on each measure. And you can argue over which is the most appropriate measure. But for the market rates, America had 36% of world GDP in 1969, the year Kagan begins with. 31% by 2001, so a marginal dilution, down to 23.5% by 2011. And at the same rate, that would go down to about 16, 17% by the early 2020s. Now, none of this should necessarily be a problem. We're talking about relative economic decline here. And the creation of larger markets for American exporters in a world where America has built the global commons. So on its face, none of this should be a problem. And I don't think it should be controversial either that this is what is happening. It's not what my book is about. My book is based on the assumption that we can all agree that that at least is happening. Here is what I focus on, and I'll boil it down to three brief points. The first is what I would give the shorthand Latin Americanization of the United States. Now, we're all familiar, particularly the panelists here, with what I'd call the triple cocktail of median wage stagnation since the 70s, of growing inequality of the distribution of income, and with the declining mobility, the most particular un-American part of that triple cocktail, the declining income mobility of Americans to sub-European levels. We're all familiar with that. We're also familiar with the fact that the 02 to 07 business cycle was the first on modern record where the median household income was lower at the end of it than at the beginning of it, to the tune of, in real terms, $2,000. And I think we're also familiar with the fact that since this recovery began in June 2009, it's now pretty much exactly 3 years, we're pretty much midway through this business cycle, that the median income has continued to drop. Now, sure, it dropped during the recession, as you would expect, but it's continued to drop ever since then, year by year. And in the year 2010, the best year so far of this recovery, with 3% GDP growth, as Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Seitz have shown, 93% of the gains of that 3% growth went to the top 1% of Americans. Now, that was up from 65% of that growth going to the top 1% of the Americans in the first year of the previous business cycle, and 45% going to the top 1% of Americans in the first year of the 1990s recovery. So you can see the trend there. It's a structural trend. All of this predates Lehman Brothers, and the trend is deepening. It is accelerating. And I think sort of final little factoid from that fascinating study they brought out last month is that the top 0.1% of Americans, the top 15,600 wealthiest families in the United States, took just under 40% of America's growth rate in 2010. And if that doesn't give you the whiff of the hacienda, of the Latin American hacienda, I don't know what will. But of course, Latin Americanization doesn't just connote very extreme inequalities. It also connotes, in its classic pattern, very destabilizing politics. I say classic pattern because, of course, Brazil and even Mexico are becoming less Latin American by that measure over time. And I think what really characterizes that kind of democracy is a tendency to swing from populism to orthodoxy and back again in great destabilizing lurches that make sensible governance, that make your ability to respond to the kind of challenges, for example, America is now facing, very, very difficult to do. We're sitting here in the heart of Washington, so I don't need to belabor the fact, that we're now, in fact, as we speak, I think Speaker Boehner is giving a speech threatening the next sovereign debt crisis at the end of this year, threatening exactly the same tactics as led up to that flirtation with a voluntary default last year. I don't need to belabor the point to you here in D.C. that the politics is dysfunctional, and so I won't. The second point is about declining U.S. competitiveness. What I've mentioned, could be a deep concern on a fairness level on an equity level, and maybe even on a health, as I've suggested, of democracy level. But you could still come back and reply. But look, in the aggregate, as a nation, America will continue to grow. And it's up to America internally how to fix it. But in terms of its relations as a power to the rest of the world, this is irrelevant. There are many reasons why it isn't irrelevant. One of which, of course, is that you do have, as most Western economies do, Britain included. Incidentally, my joke about Britain is if I was going to write a book on Britain, it would be called Time to Start Sniffing Glue. So I just wanted to underline, I'm not rosy, don't have rose-colored spectacles about any part of the West, is that if that is failing to spark that engine of consumer spending, that 70% of GDP growth in America, then growth has got to come from elsewhere. Exports is the most obvious source of growth. Now, let's look at the composition of America's export boom, or strong export growth we've seen in the last 3-4 years. There's an extraordinarily high composition there for commodities. There's been a commodity price boom. There's been a soybean boom, corn prices, etc., all of which is great for the farmers of the Midwest, and they've been doing very, very well. But if you look at the trade balance for advanced manufacturing products, the kinds of things that America ought to be dominating the world in, then it's gone from balance in the mid-1990s to $100 billion deficit annually today. And it keeps going north quite sharply, quite rapidly, including under the Obama administration. That hasn't been reversed. If you look at research and development, the classic cognitive top of the value-added chain, service sector jobs that produce innovation, that high-skilled economies do, 3-to-1 outflow to inflow advantage against America in terms of where R&D jobs are being created. And if you want more details on that, there's an excellent Harvard Business Review study in the last month or two on where R&D jobs are being created. But the bigger point, I guess, about competitiveness is that you have what my friend David Rothkopf calls a get-out-of-jail-free card, namely your ability to innovate to a degree nobody else can, has, or ever will. And Silicon Valley is, of course, Exhibit A in that get-out-of-jail-free card. Now, I spent a lot of time in Silicon Valley for this book, spent a lot of time with venture capitalists and with entrepreneurs, and came to a slightly more sobering conclusion, not as depressing as that title might imply, but certainly if you look at the overwhelming advantage America had in terms of innovation as recently as the beginning of this century, there are many areas, not excluding biotech, not excluding semiconductors, again, where that advantage is fraying. Since the turn of the century, well, since 2002, to be more precise, since Sarbanes-Oxley was enacted, America, for the first time in its history, has seen a decline in the number of listed companies. It's just not worth the while for small companies to pay these compliance costs. If you look at the financialization, what's euphemistically known as the financialization of the U.S. economy, the change of composition of venture capital funds from outfits that were run by former entrepreneurs themselves who'd started up companies themselves to former investment bankers with much shorter-term metrics, then you will look at, I think, the core point I'm making here with the competitiveness issue, the death of patient capital in America. And I had a dinner the other night, and this was the last time I saw Peter David a few days ago. And that dinner was with Jim McNerney of Boeing, who, of course, just bought out the Dreamliner. And I won't quote to you what he said, but there was a great deal of skepticism in the room from everybody that starting now, a company would be tolerated putting $20 billion over that time frame into a project like the 787. That's just the very brief sort of summary of the competitiveness point. The final point I'd like to make is the intellectual crisis that the United States is facing. As I said, in the 1990s, when I was doing the speechwriting job for Larry, there was a view in the United States and elsewhere, Britain included, that the rest of the world would increasingly do the job of the hand, we would do the job of the brain, and that this separation of cognitive and lower value-added work was inevitable, desirable. and predictable. Well, the predictive value of the standard economist's model has served us really very badly in the last 15, 20 years. And yet our revision, our ability, our willingness to revise that paradigmatic view of the world has, I think, been astonishingly limited, particularly given what happened in 2008, particularly given what happened to the efficient market hypothesis in 2008 with the collapse of Lehman Brothers. And I would just give you three or four very brief examples. One is, of course, China joining the WTO, which was going to result in a dramatic shrinkage of the trade deficit with the US, and it's, of course, gone in the opposite direction. Another is the efficient market hypothesis. A third is that productivity growth will be matched by wage growth, and, of course, they've diverged in very different directions. And a fourth, it's happening now, is that now that we've got certain amount of job creation in the U.S. economy, roughly 200,000 jobs a month in the last 6-9 months, that all we need is to sort of gin it up a little bit more, is to get that gas tank full, and then the engine will work just as it was working before the meltdown, before the Great Recession. But, of course, it wasn't working very well before the Great Recession. And it's working even less well now. And that is entirely predictable. And it's also entirely predictable that it's going to continue without substantial repair and re-engineering to work even less well. So I would suggest that the intellectual complacency, the lack of challenging of first principles, in this town in particular, and in the economics profession in particular, is quite extraordinary, quite remarkable, given just how dramatically wrong its predictive value as a model has been for this country. Now, those are the three sort of little summaries of what my book is about. I won't go on because I suspect there'll be lots more opportunity to talk, but don't get too depressed. I'm not predicting Easter Island or collapse or imminent disintegration. It's not the Statue of Liberty with a gun at her head. That I kiboshed successfully. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed, for that very lucid summary of your book. And over to you, Ezra.
You always know you're in for an optimistic talk when the sort of the optimistic kicker is, I'm not predicting imminent disintegration. Don't worry, we're fine. Well, look, thank you, Ed. I'm here to argue with the book, to tear it to shreds. I quite enjoyed it. I think one of the notable things about it is that the structure of the book is Ed sort of wandering around the country talking to really interesting idea-generating Americans. So you read it and you come away at the very least very optimistic in the innovative capacity of our people, if not particularly confident in our political institutions. I saw Tom Mann come in. Our political institutions are, at the moment, garbage. I'm not here to defend them. I'm not going to try. What I will say is that I find this whole debate largely 100% confusing. And so I want to step back from it. I agree with many of Ed's particulars, but I think most of those fall under the category of policy problems. There are things we need to talk about how to solve. They're not really, I think, properly understood as a question of decline. And the initial disagreement you have with Kagan is, I think, really illustrative of this, right? So on the one hand, you have Bob Kagan, who says, if you look at this one measure, America's share of global output has remained steady. And Obama says, that is terrific. I have not ruined the country. And then Ed comes in and he says, if you look at two or three or four other measures, in fact, it is falling, which is more as you would expect. And I kind of come in and I think, well, who cares? What does it matter at all if our relative share of GDP output is going up or going down? What is that supposed to tell us in any world? And so I think we need, when we have this talk about American declinism, which we have a lot, to sort of be a little bit more specific. What would it actually mean for America to be in decline? Are we talking about a decline in our relative geopolitical influence as compared to other world powers like Europe and China and Japan? Are we talking about a decline in our standard of living compared to them? Or are we talking a kind of absolute decline that our children will be less well off than we are? Or is it a decline in the rate of improvement? We will be better off, our children will be better off, but maybe we will not be as better off as one would have hoped. And I think if you think about it that way and you try to really pin it down, you realize that this gets very slippery. So what would it mean for us to be – let's flip it. What would it mean for us to be rising? Let's say that we are growing at 3.5 percentage points a year. Let's say, unlike as has been recently true, that growth is fairly broadly shared. And let's say that at the same time, China is growing at 8.5 percentage points a year, and by 2020, they pass us. Now, the moment they pass us, there will be a lot of media, some of it coming from my paper and my cable news network, and others coming from competitors who aren't as good. And it will be very upset. It will be very, 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 very upset. We have been passed as the world's largest economy, albeit by a country that has four times as many people as we do. And so we are now in decline. The American age is over. And I think to think about how those relative comparisons maybe mess with our heads a little bit, we should take a different scenario. So let's say now that America is growing at 3 percentage points a year, or 3% a year. And let's say that China has slowed down to grow at 4%. For China, this would be an absolute catastrophe. I mean, this is a kind of a socially destabilizing level of growth for them, given what needs to happen there. They're not going to pass us at that rate until decades from now. That would probably take some of the psychological pressure off of this decline conversation. But I would submit to you, it would be a worse world for absolutely everybody, not just the Chinese, for whom it would be a catastrophe, but for us. I mean, and not just because we'd be growing at 3 percentage points or 3% as opposed to 3.5, but because China would, you know, would not be able to buy our exports as much. They would not be producing. They would be further back on the sort of innovation curve, at which point they can really begin, you know, saving me when I get old from dying from cancer, which I'd like them to do, if they don't mind. So that would worry me quite a bit. And so the way I'd put it is, I think we in this conversation need to really seriously question this idea of how much is preeminence worth it to us. The way I like to put it sometimes is it really better to be the hyperpower in hell than a member of an expanded UN Security Council in heaven? And I don't think it's so much better to be the hyperpower in hell. I don't think that kind of front-of-the-line-ism is really telling us anything that useful. So if we are, however, talking about sort of relative measures, and I think that is probably the way most people think about decline, the way I would put the question is, whose problems would you rather have? Would you rather have Europe's problems? Their demographics look quite bad to me. Their political system actually makes ours look good. So that is quite a trick at the moment. But what's going on in the Eurozone is an absolute fracturing. It looks like they might be genuinely irredeemably flawed. Japan hasn't grown in, I think, 150 years or something. They're doing terribly. And their demographics are even worse, and their closed-offedness, if you don't mind me. I was educated in American public schools. So their closed-offedness to immigration is a serious problem for them. Culturally, I think they have some real they have some strictures or shackles they don't frankly need to have. Obviously, I don't think that China is actually even comparable in any way that is serious. But even if you do, China is becoming a middle-income country. Middle-income countries tend to slow their growth rates. We don't really know how the Chinese political system is going to deal with a slowed growth rate. We have no sense, and they don't either, frankly. I see a large amount of fracturing in sort of the continued acceleration of that economy, and I wouldn't. I very much hope for the continued success of the Chinese project, as I think one might call it, but I'm not optimistic that we are going to continue to see the kind of remarkable growth we've seen there over the last couple of decades. India, their political system makes Europe's political system look good, so I'm not going to go with that. And then, well, you know more about, but we could argue about India. Oh, you agree with that? Yes.
But you can still argue about it.
But we could still argue about it. I'd be happy to take the other side now, having taken the first one. The other thing I would just say in these conversations more generally right here is I always think it's important for people to be cognizant of how many of our problems are the fault of a kind of extrapolation. The very obvious one here is our debt and deficit issues. When you see those very scary red lines, you may have seen them on my blog. I like to post them because people put charts on Facebook and then they get a lot of hits. But as a general point, that scary red line basically means you're making an assumption. And that assumption usually isn't in the chart anywhere. And what you're saying is that healthcare costs are going to grow at the same rate of growth they have in the last 20 or 30 years. That is what our deficit problem is. And the way I think you want to think about that maybe is, okay, where in that chart do you put driverless cars? Right, because it's pretty clear that within a couple of years we're going to have driverless cars. I think I'm very convinced by that. We have some real legal issues, but they seem, frankly, at this point, surprisingly more surmountable than the technical ones. At that point, a lot fewer people die in car crashes, presumably. Now, the driverless cars thing may or may not be a major contributor to healthcare. That may end up maybe we live longer, and because of that, it's a higher cost. But it is very hard to see what healthcare costs look like in 2080. Which is what those charts tend to be. I don't think healthcare, and I do a lot of work on healthcare policy, I'm fairly optimistic here. Right now, frankly, our costs have dropped quite dramatically. We are seeing levels of healthcare cost growth that are actually sustainable for the first time in quite some time, and experts argue about why it is. It does not appear to be entirely due to the recession. But I don't think healthcare is going to be resistant to cost-reducing technological innovation for that much longer. I think some of the things that have kept it from disruptive technologies have begun to break down, and so I'm fairly optimistic. Other people may not be, and of course the flip side of talking about extrapolation is that it could be worse than we think. But in a lot of places, I think that we have let current lines do too much of the work for us, as opposed to thinking about, well, why would that continue to happen? What would possibly be the moderating impact on it? I tend to think of inequality somewhat similarly. I think inequality does – I'm quite concerned about it, and I spent a lot of time trying to change it or writing about why we should change it. But I think it has some self-regulating possibilities in it, and for much the reason that we're now having this, now that inequality has gotten very high, we're having this continuous conversation. I think it is a very good chance taxes on the rich are going to go up by quite a bit in the coming years. That won't solve all the problem, but it'll be a start. So I do think sometimes that these conversations tend to be particularly salient at moments when the lines all look really bad, and that is both partially because we've not given them time to look better, but also partially because these conversations lead to us doing things that make the lines look better. I do think our political system has deteriorated to a point that we are really facing very, very, very serious challenges. That is my central concern. I think Ed is absolutely right to emphasize it as aggressively as he does in the book. But nevertheless, I do think it is notable that most of the challenges we face, if not absolutely all of them, can be ameliorated by effective political action. To me, that is, as a bottom line, a fairly optimistic fact about what we're dealing with in this country. We do not have insolvable, I think, in most cases, technical problems or demographic problems or social problems. We got to get the folks over there to do their work a little bit better. I don't think that's easy. I don't think it is sort of very fun work. But in the end, I think we'll probably be able to do it a little bit better than we think, and that while it won't be pretty and while it won't look good and while for a long time the lines are going to look bad, we'll muddle through a lot of this, and 10 years from now things are going to look considerably brighter. Then with that, I will turn it to Glenn Hutchins to hopefully explain why I've been right about all of that, right?
I thought that was great, Ezra. Well done. I also want to start by complimenting Edward on the book. Which I've read. It is not just scrupulously reported, as you suggested, but it's also beautifully written, and it was a lot of fun to read, and I recommend it. Commend it to everybody in the room. I think of the – I'll make 4 points. First is I think of the trajectory of our economy and our role in the world not in terms of decline or ascent or even relative or absolute decline, but more in terms of equilibration. Maybe this is one of these failed economic theories. And the reason why I say that is a lot of the points of reference when we have all of these discussions about America's decline and whether it's around wages or international competitiveness or the quality of the work we do, all act as if the 1950s are what scientists would call a control group. That's the point in American history that everything gets compared to, and that was when things were normal. And I think it's highly possible that that period was a great anomaly in history and not a starting point for comparisons. And what I mean by that is we came out of World War II, in which our stimulus program, the spending on the war, had the indirect effect of destroying the productive capacity of all of our economic rivals, even if they were our allies in the war. And we had the only productive capacity in the world. And, by the way FDR finally decided during the war to conduct the material development program caused a very strengthened and revived private sector during that period. And the largest pools of labor in the world and potential productive capacity, China, the former Soviet Union, and India, all for different reasons, withdrew from the world economy. So the world was ours, and we had the only productive labor pool, the only large labor pool other than Europe in the economy, and the only productive infrastructure. And somehow that's the period to which we compare everything. And I think that that's something we need to – and I, what I see has been going on for the 30, 40 years since then is a process of equilibration as other parts of the world participate in the global economic process, and we have to adjust to that. I think that's neither decline or ascent of ours. It's just an ongoing process of the water reaching its level. The problem is – that's point one. Point two, the problem is that along the way, starting in about 1980, we have inflicted – or maybe even earlier than that – we inflicted at least three wounds on ourselves that – which we can solve but which make it very hard for us to be competitive, which I'll go back to in a minute, in this process of equilibration. The first is that we have, starting in 1980, we've gone from about 100 total debt outstanding in the U.S. economy, all levels, consumers, government, business, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mae, et cetera, has gone from a little over 100% of GDP to 350%, the highest level of debt ever accumulated in American history, other than a brief period during the Great Depression when the economy collapsed so much that the debt as a percent of the economy went up. And the history shows that countries that accumulate debt at that level to historically grow about 1% less persistently until they solve the debt problem. That is our own doing. By the way, the most of that debt is at the household and government level. Secondly, we are now in a period where, as Ed was alluded to, where we our trade deficits are structural. I personally think that's the result of two decisions made in the Nixon administration in 1971, on one hand to open to China and the other to go off the gold standard. Now, I'm not a gold bug, but it removed the trade settlement mechanism, which meant that we could do something which there's almost no analog for in modern history, which is run these massive sustained trade deficits. After 40 years of that, we have a society which is imbalanced hugely here toward consumption, and a society in China and other parts of the world which imbalanced hugely toward production and fixed investment. And given that that is a existing situation that took 30 to 40 years to get to, reversing that is going to take a very long time. And so now we are a consumption society and they are a production and investment society, and that is is another disequilibrium that will take a long time to pre-equilibrate. And then third are these massive budget deficits that we're running now, which are clearly unsustainable. We're seeing the future in Europe. The United States can't continue to do this. I mean, this whole thing about going big, where we're going to cut $4 trillion over 10 years in the deficits, still leaves $8 trillion more in new deficit we intend to create over the coming 10 years. And that's a high number because it has high expectations, unmeetable expectations for economic growth. So we are currently planning to add, in the best case, after heroic government action, $8 trillion in debt in the coming 10 years. And that is just those three major structural problems, and there are some other microeconomic problems, are wounds we've inflicted on ourselves that are hobbling us as we cope with the implications of the process of equilibration. But there are also things that are entirely in our control to solve, and we can do it. And that gets to my third point, which is I mentioned the 50s and 60s earlier, and I was a boy during that period watching the Cold War occur. I lived in this town, and the Cold War was a battle of ideas between communism and capitalism won. I think that's been replaced now by a battle of ideas between democracy plus capitalism and autocracy plus capitalism. And a lot of people think right now that the autocrats are winning because they have a political system that's functional. They can make good decisions. They can employ long-term strategies. They can do the things necessary to propel their countries forward, and the democracies are arteriosclerotic and dysfunctional. And a key test, in my view, of whether this unique system that America has been brought to the world of democracy plus capitalism plus the other features in America can work we're going to observe in the next several years as we see whether we can solve these problems that which we understand, which we have solutions to, and all we have to do is go do it. That's the third point. And the fourth point is that growth is an average. My wife, who's Chinese, tells me that most Chinese are pretty tall, but she's pretty short, but she points out that for a long time the tallest player in the NBA, Yao Ming, was Chinese. So the average head of Chinese is just an average. There are very important parts of our economy right now that are growing very rapidly. Happily, I participate in one of them, which is technology. There are some industries in which we are the world's leader, whether it's aeronautics, which you talked about earlier, or entertainment. There are companies we have, which are some of the best companies in the world. In fact, one of the things that's characterized this slow recovery is the incredible performance of the business sector. Profit levels are at historic highs. Costs are down. Product quality is up. Businesses are expanding. It's been an extraordinary performance. We have a lot of strength in our country. We have the means by which we can survive what I think is, in addition to the equilibration process, the Schumpeterian process of creative destruction that is has parts of our economy being obsoleted and replaced by new parts of the economy. And the part of the economy that I live in is growing very, very rapidly, is full of optimism and hope, and is creating products that are contributing mightily to the world. So I think that that's one of the foundations upon if we get the problem solved in this town, we can find ourselves in a very, very competitive place in a world that just has a slightly different set of equilibrium than it did 40, 50 years ago.
Absolutely superb. I now wish we had a three-hour vista before us for, you know, the proper exploration of these questions. Alas, we don't. You know, this is the point at which the moderator is supposed to show how smart he is by asking the piercing question that goes to the heart of the matter and impales everybody else on the podium. I'm not going to do that.
You know, thank you.
Give it a try. Yeah. Oh, you people from the competitive sector. Instead, what I'd like to do is to give the author of the book an opportunity to respond with appropriate brevity, you know, to the high points of what you've heard. And then, given the size and luster of this audience, I would like to go straight to you. And if there are additional unexplored differences, I'm sure that the seasoned symposiasts will take advantage of the questions to dilate on those. So, Ed, over to you.
Thank you to both of you for really very germane comments, most of which I agree with in both your cases. The area, therefore, I'm going to focus on is where I disagree, and principally that was the first part of what Ezra was saying, which is, why does this matter? And I think that's a very good question to ask. And you could, I guess, sort of bring up the example of Britain at the height of its power in 1900, where our average life expectancy was about 50, and it's now, 80. And ask, why not lie back and enjoy it? As others grow, there's no need for you to get less rich. You could continue to get rich. I understand that's a very good question, and I like your analogy of the expanded Security Council heaven. I think that's a very good one. But I think in a world where you move from roughly a third of global GDP to, say, a sixth, which I don't think is unreasonable, you lose your ability to impose outcomes in the same way that you've been accustomed to. And it's precisely because I'm pro-American that worries me. And this is the second half of the Kagan book, and this is where I agree with Kagan, which is I don't think China is it's either desirable for China to play the kind of role that the United States has played, or that it is capable of playing such a role. It's not a universal model. It's never going to have mass immigration. I wouldn't trust it, and I don't think others, including its neighbors, would trust it to uphold the global commons in the way the United States has. So economics is not a zero-sum game. The rise of others is a good thing. I agree. Geopolitics is a zero-sum game. And so I think there are real power consequences to the relative economic shift of weights. The European political system, I agree, flatters everybody except India, with which I also agree. But I tend to sort of break it down. I mean, Europe, includes Austria with 4% unemployment and Spain with 25% unemployment. And if you break down Europe into different countries, which is ultimately what it is, and I fear going back to, then you've got to talk about which bits of Europe you mean. And I think there are parts of Europe, Scandinavia and Germany, that hold real lessons, and I think you agree on this point, hold real lessons for how you deal with the skill problem facing the American middle class. Then there is the Chinese political system. Now, people have been predicting since I was an undergraduate the imminent collapse of China. and the disintegration of their system. I, in fact, first went to China in 1987 as a backpacker, as a student, but before going to university, 25 years ago. Everywhere you went in China, there was an Orwellian loudspeaker on the trains, in the hotel rooms, the hostels you stayed in, on the streets, in the shops, propaganda blaring out 24 hours a day. Only senior Communist Party officials had the right to turn it off. If you go to China now, which I did last month, it's unrecognizable. China has moved from totalitarian to authoritarian, which arguably is a bigger shift than the one from authoritarian to democratic, or as big a shift at any rate, as big a transition. And if you look at China's neighbors, which were all authoritarian, totalitarian, most have become democratic without the kind of major disruptions that we associate with regime change, say in Latin America or the Middle East. East Asia handles political transitions differently, and I think there's, whilst there's no reason to, it would be very foolish to anticipate China will have a peaceful transition, I do think it's worth correcting a very widespread conventional wisdom, not just in America, but in the West as a whole, that China's about to collapse and the wheels are about to come off and it's about to go off the road. People have been predicting that every year for two or three decades, and it hasn't happened. I'll go finally to your point about the bit of America you're living in. Look, I couldn't agree more. The chances of any other economy in the world producing an Apple or a Facebook or Twitter even are still very slim. These are companies. America does remain the most innovative country in the world, and I think it will continue to be the most innovative country in the world. But what I would say, though, is that the overwhelming predominance you had in innovation is something that you've lost in many sectors. And the Pentagon The Pentagon did a study, the Pentagon Advisory Board did a study 2-3 years ago of the 19 most critical areas of high-tech manufacturing for the national defense infrastructure of the United States. America led in all 19 of them at the end of the Cold War in 1991. It now leads in only 6 out of those 19. And this is, and I place a great deal of emphasis in this book, on the sense of alarm that the Pentagon feel, and Admiral Mullen and people like that. And I think they're not economists, and they have a different perspective on these things. But from a national security perspective, America's loss of innovative lead in areas that we don't hold in the palm of our hands, but are nevertheless just as real as Apple, is a matter of deep and legitimate concern. And it's, of course, inevitable. In just the same way America could never have 50% of the global economy in perpetuity, it's never going to be the only innovator. Final postscript to that point, because I know I'm taking up quite a lot of time, is that, as everybody here knows, the overwhelming source of entrepreneurship is immigrants. This country is immigrants. New businesses tend to disproportionately be started by educated immigrants. Now, I can understand a political system for 2 or 3 years after 9/11, educating them and then putting them on a plane back home. But we're now 11 years after 9/11, almost, and I see no sign that America is going to discontinue this profoundly irrational, what Mayor Michael Bloomberg calls national suicidal policy, of training the world's best and brightest to the best that they can be trained, subsidizing that training, because if you're doing an engineering degree at Carnegie, Mellon or Caltech, you're not paying even a fraction of what it really costs to educate you to get your doctoral degree, and then putting them on a plane back home. That is a form of subsidizing not just your competition, but your competitive innovation. And it's all happened at a time when a lot of these people, for the first time in their history, Indians, Chinese, have entrepreneurial opportunities at home and want to go home. This is not the pragmatic American way of responding to challenges, and it's not, unfortunately, and this is a source of my pessimism, a flash in the pan, this policy mistake. It's a sustained policy mistake that shows every sign of continuing. And I guess that's why I'm pessimistic. You're right. In theory, a lot of these problems are solvable. Not all of them, but a lot of them are. Anyway, actually, I can witter. I mean, my mother beckons again, so I'll stop. Please.
So let me ask you just one question on that, because I think that was clarifying, right? And so Kagan argues, too, that the issue here is geopolitical influence, that there's sort of a calculation or formula that you have X amount of global output that gives you sort of, you know, the biggest weight in geopolitical decisions. That does require, as far as I understand the implication of that, that does require for us to maintain our preeminence, basically, that these other countries can't grow very fast. I mean, there's no, given the math of their populations, there's no other way to make that happen. Yep. So when I hear that calculation, I just think, number one, for a variety of reasons related to things that other people's innovations do for me, for, you know, just simply humane reasons about wanting people to not be in poverty, it seems to me that if you run the full calculation there, it's not clear to me that it's a better world. And second, it seems a little bit too binary. Diplomacy has a lot of actors, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, as China grows, and I mean, when we're talking about a world in which we've gone down to a six, I mean, yeah. China's much, much larger than it is now. We have no idea what they're – I'm not a China pessimist, but we have no idea what other people's political systems are going to look like, given a rich China, a rich India, a rich – but, I mean, if you talk to folks on the national security side of the Obama administration or the State Department more generally – This sort of knitting together coalitions in different areas of people who, you know, are balancing out China, I mean, that would seem to me to imply that there's a great work of diplomacy to be done in the coming decades. But I just don't see how a sustainable answer to that question is, well, we either have to hope or actually orient policy such that these other countries don't get rich enough to make our level of global GDP output smaller than it's been during this very unusual post-war period. That doesn't – not does it not seem possible, but in a full accounting, I'm just not sure how it's even desirable.
Can I briefly respond? No, do we not want to get into that?
No, go ahead, respond.
Well, Bill,
don't wait for me.
There's no natural way to cut this off, but Ed, as the author, you can have the last word in this round, and then we're going to you, I promise.
Very briefly. Look, I think the decline that can be prevented here is the decline in the attractiveness of the American model. Mm-hmm. Relative economic decline can't be prevented, and it's not necessarily desirable. In fact, it's definitely undesirable. I agree with you. But the American model, which is the source of a lot of its leadership to build these coalitions and this diplomacy in the decades, is in a very serious state of disrepair. And Obama hasn't really reversed that to nearly the degree that we were hoping he would. And it is a very difficult thing to do. I guess that's why I say time to start thinking, because it's the model.
Since this was one of your themes, Glenn, yes. You got the real.
So I'm just going to say, that's why I would contend that what we have is a governance problem. You might call it the model. But I think of decline as having something more to do with something analogous to the fact that you're an aging athlete and you're never going to have the same quickness and strength that the young people coming in behind you and you're in decline. In this case, we know what the problems are. We know what the solutions are to the problems. We know in most cases how long it would take us to solve the problems. All we need to do is have the political will to do it. And so I think the real problem here is how we govern ourselves. And I think that's contributing to a very separate problem from some sort of innate or irreversible decline we're in.
Well, you know, as a representative of the Governance Studies Division here at Brookings, I assure you I did not pre-engineer this conversation so that the intersection of the three Venn diagrams, you know, of this panel converged on the proposition that it's the governance stupid, but that appears to be it. And now there are two roving microphones. Let me warn you in advance, it is mathematically impossible for me to get to all of the questions that you want to pose, but I'll do my best. So where are the microphones? Excellent. We'll start with this gentleman right here. And if you would begin by stating your name and if you have an institutional affiliation that you think would be particularly revealing.
Ken Dillon, CNC Press. A generation and a half ago, there was a Georgetown University professor, rather well known, named Carol Quigley, who wrote about these things and lectured about these same problems, but from a perspective often of a civilization, in other words, Western civilization, not Europe, not the U.S., and so on. To what extent is it useful to think about these problems on a civilizational level.
Thank you.
I'll say something brief to that, which will really be a reply to what Glenn just said, because I'm not qualified on civilizational, but it does dovetail with your question, which is I don't think everything is easily solvable. I don't think we know the answers to everything. An example I would give is education. What has happened in terms of educational outcomes in this country is not a simple thing. It's not just a question of do we assess our teachers properly, or do we test our children properly, or do we pay teachers properly, or are our unions too strong, or are our unions too weak? Are there too many single parent families? It's many, many things. I quote somebody in this book, it took decades to get into the educational mess that K through 12 is in a lot of America, not all of America, and it will take decades to get out, assuming we know the answer. Now, this applies to other Western countries too. But this isn't something that were governance sparking properly. We would just be passing a bill and fixing education. It's been tried before. It doesn't work. It needs a lot more thinking. And I don't know what that thinking would produce. So it's not really an answer to your question. I'm not a civilizational expert, but I think education is a core part of civilization.
Wow. A sea of hands. You know, just to prove that I'm paying attention, there's a gentleman way in the back there with his hand up.
This speaks to Mr. Klein's point about reevaluating the value that the U.S. places on preeminence. Also connecting that to the governance question, however, there's a significant sector of the American political spectrum that sees American exceptionalism as, you know, a dogma. So how are we to go about questioning the value we place on preeminence when that's simply almost fiated by the political powers?
With our chins jutted firmly forward, ready for the blows. I think there's more serious discussion about this than people give it credit for sometimes. Number one, I should say, I don't disagree at all with Ed's sort of clarification of the question there. If what we're talking about is retaining the attractiveness of the American model so others want to partner with us, so others want to reform in our direction, I don't think there's any argument anywhere on that. That kind of American exceptionalism is and should be, I think, widely shared. That said, what I'm trying to argue against here is that it can tip into a kind of requirement for or even tacit cheering for the immiseration of the rest, right? That China remains poor enough that they're not a problem for us. India remains poor enough that they're not a problem for us. And I think that most people, when you really put that in front of them, don't feel that way. And I think there's been a pretty sophisticated discussion around this, led, I think, by Fareed Zakaria with the Rise of the Rest concept, which I think has been very good. Obviously, Tom Friedman and others have put this out there. But I will say that the thing I think people miss the most in this conversation that I try to emphasize is, and this goes to what Glenn does when he's not here, what really makes our lives better year by year by year by year, right? When we talk about why our lives are better than the lives of maybe our grandparents or our great-grandparents, we're generally speaking about the advance in the march of technology. We're also speaking about political institutions and how that have allowed economic growth and technological advancement. But we are on a broad way talking about technology. And I cannot imagine, I mean, to speak to the point of the Briton living 100 years ago, dying at age 47, the fact that we invented penicillin, that was a big deal. That was really great for them. And the idea that I could take advantage of the productive, of the innovative capacities of Asia is huge for me because I am a deeply selfish person who wants to live forever. And so I take that seriously, and I think in the political conversation we should too. In the end, Bill Gates has a great line on this, I think. He says, ask yourself, if China invents the solution to our energy problems tomorrow, a endlessly reproducible, cheap source of clean energy, and thus they take the lead in the energy economy, is that a bad day for America or a good day for America? And the answer is that is the best day for America. That is a better day than we have had in a very long time. And so I do think that we need to get away from this discussion in which the only variable is our level of power, right? The rise of other countries will not hopefully primarily be felt by us in terms of how we jockey for influence at the United Nations or elsewhere, but will be felt for us in terms of other countries being parts of the global community and innovating and producing culture and technology that we can use and benefit from.
Oh, a sea of hands. Yes, sir, in the corner over there.
My name is Vijayendra Kumar, and I've been in new product development and tangentially in manufacturing my entire career. I have two questions or two comments. One is, what would be the impact of the availability of low-cost natural gas in the United States as far as manufacturing is concerned? And two is, I entirely agree with you about the lack of skilled personnel, both in engineers and also at the vocational level. And I've come into contact with that too. So if we do have sensible immigration policies, how would that impact the growth of the United States?
I mean, hopefully good in terms of the attractiveness of manufacturing, the costs for the input costs for manufacturers, hopefully good. I mean, I do have a larger meta concern about global warming and a very familiar plea for American leadership, and I'm afraid a very familiar expectation it's not going to come in the near future. But that's not the direction of your question. It will make manufacturing a better cost proposition. And I forget the second question. Sorry. Immigration.
Yeah.
Were we agreeing? We were agreeing, right? Yeah, it sounded like the premise of your question was in agreement. Yeah.
Glenn?
I think natural gas is a hugely...
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Bill. First time Galston's want to actually hear what I had to say. we're friends here. I think natural gas is a very important phenomenon, but like a lot of these issues, and I forgot which of you two said it, but I think I didn't mean to imply anything else. I think most of these problems have been 20 to 30 years in the making. You're going to be a quarter century into solving as well. There's no panacea. And it turns out natural gas is a very similar place. Right now, rough numbers, on a BTU equivalent basis, natural gas sells at about 25% the price of oil. That will equilibrate, use the term I've been using today. But it takes a lot of time. It's historically taken somewhere between 25 and 35 years for us to switch over the course of American history from one form of energy consumption to another, because not only do you have to produce the energy, but you have to store it, you have to transmit it, you have to distribute it, you have to have end-use equipment at the far end of the system to use it. And that entire retooling of an energy distribution and consumption system takes about a quarter century. And that's why today, even though we're generating a huge amount of natural gas, we're not... the prices are so low because we don't have the means yet by which to consume it. That's a problem that will be solved. There's immense amounts of capital going into solving that problem today, and I'm not an expert on the global warming aspects of natural gas. I understand they're better than other hydrocarbons, but it's also an abundant source here for the United States. I think it's a very important thing. On immigration, I completely agree with Ed, by the way, on the issue of education. That is one of the – there are three or four – microeconomic problems I think are very important to us to address: immigration, infrastructure, education, and taxes. As the four key things that have to be addressed. The thorniest of those is, of course, education. Right. And you're no doubt about that. Actually, the easiest of those, from a purely technical perspective, I know the politics of this are impossible, is immigration. One of the things I say when I come to this town is, you know, they say to me, what can government do to increase jobs? And I say, nothing. Government doesn't create jobs. Businesses are created, and businesses hire people. And one thing that's very, very clear is that immigrants create lots of businesses. 25% of all companies launched in technology in the last 10 years have had an immigrant founder. 52% of tech startups today have an immigrant founder. Here's one of my favorite statistics, which I just wrote down here, which is more than 40% of today's Fortune 500 companies were founded by immigrants or their children. And those companies today produce $4.2 trillion of revenue and have 10 million employees. It's very, very clear that that's what creates jobs, is people who start businesses like that. And it's absolutely, to quote Mayor Bloomberg, suicidal not to allow them to come here to do that. And it's something we know how to do and can do very quickly, by the way.
Well, if I may break out of the moderator's role for just 15 or 20 seconds. The reason that we have an insane immigration policy is decliningly a function of 9/11 and increasingly a function and a microcosm of the governance crisis. Right. It is easy to explain in game theory terms, you know, why people who want comprehensive immigration reform, a.k.a. Democrats, will not accept a freestanding, H-1B visa proposal, and vice versa. And so this is just one more piece of evidence that to a first approximation, it is the governance stupid, because this is such a manifestly sub-sub-sub-optimal outcome that it's hard to imagine a worse outcome. But here we are, and it's easily explained in governance terms. And now for a question from the series' most faithful attender in the front row. Sorry to make you walk from the back row.
So I'd like, if you can answer that, that'd be great. I had to wait so long for the question, I forgot what it was. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report, and I'm fascinated by the book, and I've seen you in other venues, including a great interview with Charlie Rose. So I love the intellectual content of this stuff. I want to ask you about a question that I think is captured in the first of your 3 points, and which is also something that the man sitting behind me and his co-author write about in their most recent book. It's even worse than you think or than we think. And that's the concept that, and I'm going to steal their term. Their term is about asymmetric polarization in American politics. And it strikes me that instead of avoiding the sort of class warfare, 99% versus 1%, or how much does the 0.01% have, instead of doing it in those sort of terms that set up an argument, if we just simply say we have dramatic asymmetry in our income, personal incomes, and picture in this country. We have a dramatic political asymmetry in our governance circumstances today. Mr. Hutchins was saying, for example, we all know what the problems are, we know what the solutions are, we lack the political will. And it seems to me that if we look carefully at what's been happening over the last X number of years, it's no longer clear that we know what the solutions are, we just lack the political will. It's that we have come to a place where there is this dramatically different perspective about what will solve the problem. And I don't know whether that's what Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein would say, but my point is you spent a lot of time out there talking to some very interesting people in a variety of places. And I'm interested to know whether you saw examples of this asymmetry, whether those people talk about these asymmetries, and to what extent you think this is a way of characterizing the state in which you found the America about which you just wrote.
Thank you. It's a very good question. I am read and reviewed, in fact, it's even worse than it looks, with great pleasure, and agreed with almost all of it. I deliberately spent most of my time on this book outside of the Beltway, partly for selfish reasons, because, you know, sitting here covering the horse race, you know, can be bad for the soul. But also, most of the travel I'd done in America on work had been on the horse race, so I know, you know, Council Bluffs very, very well, and places like that. I think to get back to the governance question that you're actually asking, the reason why I'm a little bit more pessimistic, perhaps, than Ezra and Glenn, is because I don't think that the governance problem is something dreamt up by people in Washington just to annoy us all. I think it's deeply rooted beyond the Beltway in trends that go back many decades, which are themselves getting worse. And, you know, whether you look at it economically in terms of the concomitant polarization going on in the economy, but the bifurcation economically going on, whether you look at the big sort, as Bill Bishop has beautifully chronicled, or indeed what conservative commentators like Charles Murray, who I think on the wrong premise are identifying the right problem. The source of my pessimism is precisely because I don't think the political polarization is easily unwound. And as Tom and Norm point out very, very comprehensively and convincingly, when you have a separation of powers and political polarization, something's got to change. I mean, the alternative is a constitutional convention, right, which is unimaginable. So we've got to hope that this polarization is shallow and evanescent and is for some reason going to dissipate rapidly. I just can't see how or why.
Let me come in on the other side of that for a minute. I consider myself a full devotee of Mann and Ornstein, and it's an honor to see you here.
You've made that clear.
And I think it's important, though, in this discussion to also realize that as divided as we often seem, the American people, for better or for worse, have fairly weak views on policy. We often will look at a debate in D.C. that polarizes and say, well, this is evidence that we simply cannot get along in this country, that we are too far divided to come together around solutions anymore. And I don't think it's that at all. I think if you really seriously look at just the last 10 years, you don't need to go back into a bygone era. 5 years ago, the individual mandate was a Republican policy in good standing. 5 years ago, Newt Gingrich was sitting on a couch with Nancy Pelosi calling for a cap-and-trade bill for carbon. 5 years ago, George W. Bush would, 1 year later, pass an economic stimulus bill called that very thing. What does appear to happen is that the bases take cues from the party. And I take Mann and Ornstein's work and other political science alongside it as sort of essentially making the point that in recent decades, Washington has moved from playing a role where it took the somewhat inchoate opinions out in the country in which there are disagreements but in which people outsource, you know, some of their thinking to trusted elites and built consensus around them, figured out a way forward with them. It has become instead a polarization machine in which it takes what could be a consensus and polarizes it, and we have think tanks in town that do that work, and we have op-ed columnists in town to do that work, and cable news networks, and 100 other things, and we have the sorting mechanisms you talked about earlier. But the one thing, the reason I'm maybe somewhat more optimistic than you are on it is that I think if you ask yourself, will polarization be an evanescent phenomenon? Will polarization, is there a way we can turn it back? The answer is definitely no, and we're screwed. But I think if you ask yourself, is there a way that we can accept polarization as an enduring phenomenon of American political life and make sufficient reforms to our America, to the political system, such that it can work in that context, I think it's much easier to see a pathway forward. And I will refrain from going into what Bill knows I desperately want to do and give everybody my political reform agenda.
The F word.
He means a filibuster, folks. He does not mean – I don't just get up here and curse usually when I do it. But I do think this is – I do think you can be more optimistic about it than feeling that we need to completely turn back the clock on sort of how people react to these things.
I think we make the – I'm not sure I agree with you. Because I think we need to make the distinction between, on the one hand, having a philosophical debate or kabuki theater for the hustings, whichever one we think about it, about let's look at the budget deficit. Absolutely no increases in taxes, absolutely no cuts in entitlements. That's a big philosophical taxes versus spending debate. And that's either happening for political happening as a philosophical in some places, or is kabuki theater for purposes of making voters think that there's something real that's something to energize them to vote. But you get inside this town, you talk to people who are in the negotiations, and they know within a very high degree of precision exactly what the compromises are that have to be made for both those things to get done to get a deal. So we know how to solve that problem, even though it's a big philosophical debate that's polarizing. And we also know that in the end, when the problem gets so great, there was a crisis in front of us, how we're going to solve it. It's just a matter of when our political institutions will let us do what we know we're going to do, my view.
Well, my view is twofold. You know, first of all, regrettably that we have reached the end of our allotted time, and I've extended promises to all that we would end on time. Secondly, Ezra used the phrase trusted elites. in his most recent response. And one of the defining features of the current American political and cultural scene is that there are no trusted elites. And if I were to ask to name the single biggest difference between the time that I was a boy 50 years ago and now, that would be it. There's populism of the left, populism of the right, and no trust whatsoever. With that, let me remind you all that Ed Luce will be at the table signing books, and let me thank you all for coming and being such a good audience.